This is Dylan FM, a Freak Music Club podcast. I'm Bob Dylan. If you love Dylan, you're in the right place. This season, we're going deep on Time Out of Mind to celebrate its 25th anniversary. Here's your host, Craig Danieloff.
Wesley Stace took the stage name of John Wesley Harding and claimed in an early song that he was the bastard son of Bob Dylan and Joan Baez, so it should come as no surprise that he's got some thoughts on Bob Dylan. As you'll hear today, he's an enthusiastic fan who's able to share a performing musician's perspective on Time Out of Mind, Live Bob, and many other things. As John Wesley Harding, Mr. Stace released fantastic albums such as Here Comes the Groom, which he recorded in 1989 with The Attractions, Confessions of St. Ace from 2000, and over the last 10 years, he's returned to his given name for a string of records, including the recently released Late Style. He's also the author of 4 novels, which were very well reviewed, and has written for the New York Times, the Washington Post, and others. I'll link to some great Dylan writing he's done, as well as his music, in the show notes. Wes also hosts my favorite New York City entertainment evening, the Cabinet of Wonders, in which he invites a half a dozen friends, musicians, authors, comedians, etc., and puts on a modern cabaret. Check the link in the show notes to drool over the killer artists that you've missed at 100-plus editions of this fantastic event, or to look for tickets to future evenings. I wanted to talk to Wes, as well as other songwriters, musicians, and artists that you'll hear from in future episodes, to get their perspectives on Dylan and Time Out of Mind. I got what I bargained for and more, as you're about to hear. It's a long one, so sit back and enjoy my conversation with Wesley Stace. So Wes, thank you very much. I appreciate you being willing to come talk about Time Out of Mind.
Delighted to do so.
I actually found a fantastic quote from you in the piece you wrote about the Clinton Halen book review, which would be another subject. And what you wrote in that piece was, in the 80s, he couldn't buy himself a good review with some of his finest songs. Now, age 68, he can't avoid them. Comment on how you felt about Dylan in the 80s, 90s, Knocked Out, Loaded, Under the Red Sky, up through even World Gone Wrong, and pre-Time Out of Mind. What were you thinking?
Well, to cut to the punchline of the answer, he only put out one decent collection of songs in the 90s, and it was Time Out of Mind. I mean, what else was in the 90s? The folk songs, Under the Red Sky was at the beginning, and surely the next album post-dates the 90s.
Yeah, correct. So it had been, just to give you the rundown, it was 7 years since Under the Red Sky, which was his last original.
Right.
It was 5 years since World Gone Wrong and six since Good As I've Been to You. And Love and Theft, I don't think, was till 2001 or something.
Because it came out on 9/11, right. Great release date for that album. Yeah, so, you know, it's the only good collection of songs he put out in the 90s, of his own songs. I love the folk records, but they're records of traditional folk songs, presumably done to buy some time or reconnect with the traditional or whatever. Very exciting, but not his songs. Under the Red Sky is a thin collection of short songs that sounds like they could barely be bothered to make an album, really. I mean, it's not a very persuasive, I'm quite fond of it, but it's not a persuasive collection on any level. And then you get in the, you know, back in the 80s, Knocked Out, Loaded, and Down in the Groove don't seem for a second like they were made as albums at the same time. They both have the feeling of being chucked together from different sessions and odds and ends, and they end up as an album. So then the previous good album would be what? Empire Burlesque?
Yeah. I mean, Oh Mercy would be the bigger milestone.
I always forget Oh Mercy. I always forget Oh Mercy because, again, it's of course, an album full of great songs, but I always forget it because it is so minor. It's such a, it was, of course, a big comeback record, but there's 5 very short songs on it. It's like, for the whole, since Empire Burlesque, Dylan couldn't manage to like write any lyrics of any length or didn't want to or whatever. I don't want to hypothesize on any level about what he could and couldn't do or his reasons for doing it, because that, you know, unless he writes it down, we don't know. But it feels to me that at least with when you arrive at Time Out of Mind, and then on all the subsequent records, he suddenly can't stop writing lyrics. You know, the songs are long. I remember when Love and Theft came out and I listened to Summer Days the day before the record came out, which would have made it the Sunday night before 9/11, to be more specific. And they played it on one of those folkier stations in New York. And I was like, oh, this is a nice Dylan kind of jump blues song. And it just never ended. It just kept going. So many words, like you couldn't. And when you think back to Oh Mercy and you think back to Under the Red Sky, and the fact that since Empire Burlesque, which is 85, I guess, there wasn't anything that was a decent collection of songs for 12 years. I mean, I really, it's not that Oh Mercy isn't great. It's great, but it is slight in feel, as though there's just not a lot around. And of course, I know that he left Dignity off it and could have put Series of Dreams on and all that, but that's the album he chose to put out. It felt like getting a, as a fan, it felt like getting a lyric out of him at that time was, it was agony for him to even just produce these words. You think of those lyrics on Under the Red Sky and 2x2 and, you know, the TV talking song, and it's
a lot of nursery rhyme stuff.
Yeah, a lot of nursery rhyme type stuff. And of course, with Time Out of Mind, suddenly you get words, and there's lots of words. So that was the initial thing. And I certainly remember I had a friend who worked at Columbia, and he sent me or gave me a 4-track CD, I think, with, it was called like something, 4 tracks from Love and Theft or something. And I can't remember what was on it, except Lovesick was on it and Million Miles was on it. It was a little 4-track promo. I've probably still got it.
Yeah, that came out, right. That came out in August of that year.
Right. Was it a legal thing or was it a promo? I mean, you know, was it a
it was radio.
Right, it was a radio.
I think it probably circulated, you know, a little early in some quarters, but there is a, you know, nice press color cover radio version, yeah.
Right, so that's the thing that I got. And so I was very excited with that because, and I think I remember I phoned up Chuck Prophet and asked him if he wanted to hear it. I was living in a basement in San Francisco, which going back to, you know, which was where I was when I saw the news of Princess Diana dying, which, you know, you said you discussed. And so that would have been all the same period. But I mean, you know, clearly in the 80s and 90s, it's very, if you look at Dylan only as a producer of albums, after, you know, Street Legal, Religion, Shot of Love, Infidels, Empire Burlesque, to judge him by his albums from then until Time Out of Mind, he is clearly not at the top of his recording game, either in comparison to the 60s or the 70s, or indeed the 90s and aughts. But to only consider him in terms of his recorded output is a silly thing to do anyway, because we know what he was doing then. He was on the road all the time, and he decided to take the art and make it live and do it again and again and again and again with an ever-changing band. And that was the artistic project. What, how this does, so, you know, so although I say those things about those albums, which I don't consider Under the Red Sky to be a great record, I don't think anybody does, but, you know, what's around it and those live gigs is kind of interesting. What leads up to Time Out of Mind, where that becomes relevant, is he's finally got a band who he's got on the road with him who play good and can play the folk songs he liked playing and Trail of the Buffalo if you want and all that stuff. He's finally got a band who he can take into the studio and make a record with. Now, I know they're only kind of half of the musical component of Time Out of Mind, but Dylan did not make Down in the Groove, Knocked Out Loaded, under the red sky with a drilled touring outfit. He made them with session musicians piecemeal. I know Tom Petty and the Heartbreaks, they'd done a tour together, and there's one or two songs on one of those albums. I can't remember which. But yeah, on Knocked Out Loaded, right. But then, you know, Street Legal, that was an album that he kind of made with a band he'd got together to do a tour with, and he then did the tour with them. But I can't think of another example before this, certainly in a long while, where he's got a band. He's been working with that band for, you know, I know that they're changing. Bass player's always the same. But, you know, that it's a changing, developing band. But, I mean, he's got two or three of those drummers on this record alone, I think. You know, Winston Watson's on it. I think David Kemper's on it. They all pass through the touring band. Keltner's on it, isn't he? Brian Blades, I don't think, was a touring drummer. But, you know, so there are components of that touring band. So I think one of the reasons why you get a decent album out of it is because of that other project that he was doing where he was playing, where he got a band that he was comfortable with playing with. And then after this is, I mean, I don't even like to have all the facts in my head, so I have to guess at some of them. But hasn't he produced almost all his albums since this?
Yes, this was the last, Lanois and Time was the last producer.
See, you know, so he goes back where he's safe, because Oh Mercy had been, you know, a critical success and was certainly some kind of a comeback album. But I've always thought very like New Morning, in the sense that though it was a critically lauded comeback album, it was in fact not quite able to withstand that need of people for a comeback. There wasn't quite enough there, would be my personal opinion. And in New Morning, I guess we know from Chronicles, he wrote to be a slightly slight album. There's that good quote about how he wanted the songs to be like puffs of smoke or something that disappear. I can't quite remember. But so I think of Oh Mercy a bit like New Morning. And the real come, if not for New Morning, yeah. And the real comeback is going to come, you know, with Blood on the Tracks a little bit later, sparking, you know, suddenly a wonderful flowering of albums. So, and I think of Oh Mercy in that spot and Time Out of Mind as being the real start of the real Dylan comeback, which was then remarkable. But I also see Time Out of Mind as a necessary step in the direction of a much greater album, which is Love and Theft, which I think contains almost everything that Time Out of Mind tries to do well, Love and Theft does better and is a better album on almost every level, I'd say.
Do you think Love and Theft suffers from not having a third party producer?
No, not at all. I think it's perfect. In fact, I think Love and Theft is a perfect record. And I put it right up there with my other perfect Dylan records, which are Highway 61 and Blood on the Tracks. I put Love and Theft right at the top of the pile. I think it is one of the moments when Dylan, the creator, achieved the perfect blend of creating something and destroying it at the same time, mastering it entirely. And I could theorize about that. And it's all relevant to Time Out of Mind. And he then, unfortunately, went and repeated that brew on some increasingly disappointing albums, climaxing in Tempest, of which Modern Times and Together Through Life are the two I can remember. But I think they're both not very good, those records.
What's the thing he created and destroyed? That sound
No. I think the way that, well, it's all part of the conversation about Time Out of Mind. So perhaps if we talk about Time Out of Mind, I can tee up for why, you know, Love and Theft, I think, succeeds at the things that... See, I think at this stage in Dylan's amazing songwriting career, I mean, this is just my thoughts about it. I don't claim to be right about any of this stuff. And I'm talking about it because you've asked me to talk about it. I have no wish for these feelings to be, you know, like, considered deeply. They're just mine. But I feel that... at this point in Dylan's life, it's more about the totality of what the songs are about than what the individual songs are necessarily saying on their own. You can feel in Time Out of Mind the totality of sickness in the narrator, the woman who's left him, the road he's on. When it gets to Love and Theft, the totality of the songs in Love and Theft is saying so much more, I think, about the world and Dylan himself. It presents a much larger, wider picture. I mean, and to the point, the totality of the songs where he might well say, you know, my uncles are this, my aunts are that, and then forget it in the next verse about something else. And then he might claim his aunt's someone else entirely a verse later. It's like they seem so just whacked together, the lyrics, some of them. And I think that process of collage, and which is what helped Dylan start writing songs again, I think that process of collage begins less satisfactorily on Time Out of Mind and reaches full flowering on Love and Theft. And also, Love and Theft is musically a lot more interesting. Poor Boy, Floater, you know, there. So that's another way that I prefer Love and Theft, and also, and I prefer the production. But also, I think that the stealing and magpie tactics that may have gone on throughout his career, but certainly were first heavily noticed on Time Out of Mind, you know, lines from this and bits from that. That, whatever you think of it, whether you think that's cultural appropriation or bad or good, whatever you think about it, that reaches again its full flowering on Love and Theft, where you hear something like Gabriel blow your horn, and then someone says, that is exactly the same as Gene Austin's The Lonesome Road. And you listen to it and you go, fuck me, he just stole it. He just stole that from there with no attribution. Sure, it's out of copyright and that's allowed. And, you know, and I really like Dylan's reaction to that. When somebody said once, dared say in an interview in Rolling Stone, you know, will you, you know, do you, and he said that, you know, those fuckers, you know, those people who accuse, you know, whatever. She was so angry about it. But the funny
wussies
thing is,
and pussies.
Yeah, there you go, exactly. And but the funny thing about it is, if I wrote a song called, you know, if I used the chorus of Blowing in the Wind tomorrow in a song of mine, in the way he uses these out of copyright, he would not consider himself a wussy and a pussy when I found myself in court really fucking quickly, you know. So it is slightly you know, he is richer and greater and, you know, has better lawyers than everybody else, but it is kind of an interesting, it is an interesting thing that someone has yet to fully dissect and write a really good book about. Though I've read a few things here and there. And I mean, the same with the paintings, and the same with, you know, the bits in Chronicles that that incredibly assiduous critic Scott Warmoth is always finding. You know, it's like, it's all interesting stuff, but someone's yet to really, really dissect that. But anyway, that process also begins in Time Out of Mind when you're looking at the, you know, riding in the buggy, Miss Mary Jane, riding in the buggy, Miss Mary Jane, I'm a long way from home. Sally's got a house in Baltimore and it's full of chicken pie. I mean, it's because it's a kid's folk song, and there it is in this. And that was, and I'm sure Dylan had done that before. We've all done it, but I think this might be the first place we really noticed that happening. And in Love and Theft, there's much more of it. And it's really interesting.
What Scott said and others is that prior to Time Out of Mind, it was kind of ideas. He stole things, but you couldn't point at them. And this is the period where you now get substantial quotes. As you say, the collage effect or the collage process really, you know, accelerated here. And as he and others have pointed out, you know, if that's bad or if that's a cheat, you know, you try to do it and come up with that album because it ain't going to happen.
No, quite. But you know, what I do like about that is the way it still ties Dylan, who's now, you know, a Nobel winning great poet, which we've always known he was, but you know, that it's true now. What I like about it is it still ties him to a concept of kind of modernism and, you know, collage and, you know, the fragments that sure are ruins and all that kind of thing, even though he now thinks of himself as, you know, the poet who has the lyre on the cover of, you know, and Homer and, you know, and all this stuff. It's, he thinks of himself as an old, as a representative of old fashioned values. And yet this is still, there's still something kind of postmodern about all this stealing and you know, throwing it around. And it's all, I mean, I think it's all, it's a little bit infuriating, but it's mostly just brilliant and thoroughly entertaining and makes sifting through stuff extra interesting.
Let's go to the album release. So A, you had the early four track. Immediate reaction, and what was the build there? So we know what we thought of the time before, and then this thing comes out.
Immediate reaction.
Songs, production.
Yeah, the immediate reaction was just fantastic. In September, I played Freight and Salvage, and I remember playing Trying to Get to Heaven Before They Closed the Door, because I just wanted to get inside that song and see how it worked. It seemed to me the best Dylan song in years and years and years. Years and years and years. I mean, just like back to, I don't know, Every Grain of Sand or something, or In the Summertime, or one of those grand songs, or Joker Man or something. I mean, it was such a great song. And what was great about it was, it, this isn't the key it's in on the album, but, you know, and that chord, that is, to me, just discovering how to play that chord, what it was, how it did it on the recording, was very exciting. And I think that kind of jazzy chord that you find there, I mean, that could be a chord that is created by the fact that the bass is so predominant on these songs, and perhaps the bass is playing a substitution over a slightly less jazzy chord than that, but the effect is that chord. And when I played it acoustic, I just loved the set, you know, working out what that chord was. And then I think that's what I get so excited about on Poor Boy and Floater, because these are really interesting jazz songs, chordally, with, you know, diminished chords and beautiful little weaving in and out of each other introductory lines. And I think that begins here. So Trying to Get to Heaven Before They Close the Door, Not Dark Yet, everyone liked that one, and Cold Iron's Bound. I really liked Cold Iron's Bound. And of course, you hear the record and immediately you're hearing Dylan's voice like that. It's right there. It's right there at the front of the record. Not like squashed, like on Under the Red Sky, like a bit disappearing. It's right there. And I presume that was a production decision by Lanois. I don't know what they did to it. Probably sounds like, you know, putting it through an amp or something, maybe. But it's very kind of slightly distorted, and it sounds great. So that's exciting. You know, you can hear the voice really good. And then, you know, those bass-heavy parts are very interesting. You know, and I don't know how the album was really made. I mean, to be honest, I can pontificate about fucking anything, but I can't really speak with any great certainty about that. But, you know, the percussion tracks are interesting on it, on some, like the, got the drums over in the right hand speaker, but is it actually a percussion part that's over there, or is it all the whole drum kit? You know, it's kind of interesting.
It's the two drummers.
Right.
I'll send you, I had a conversation with Mark Howard, the engineer, for about an hour, and he talks a lot about it. And basically, he put Keltner on one side, he said, and Brian on the other. I mean, you know, in the mix. But
where's Winston Watson and David Kemper? I mean, they're in there too, right?
Kemper's not, I don't think, in at all. Watson got sent home after a day or two, but he's on. I think it's maybe I'm spacing out the track. One of the tracks, he laid down the loop. Right. So I think he's only on one. You know, one of the things that's going to be interesting on the box set that's supposedly about to come out is, you know, he did record a lot with that band, or more with that band, and then by the time they got to Miami, you know, Watson was there, and then he left the way Mark Howard tells it, he went home for the weekend to go to an art exhibit, and Dylan called Keltner and Lenoir called Blades, and he never came back. Anyway, there's all kinds of stuff there. I think, you know,
I want to correct myself because I actually have a chart of who played on what.
Yes.
Winston Watson played on Dirt Road Blues only, and Kemper played on Standing in the Doorway only. So Dirt Road Blues is the one that had the loop of Kemper from rehearsal.
Right, right.
But you were correct. They're both there.
Huh, thank you.
Please keep going with your analysis of what you hear, because that's the fantastic thing. So Trying to Get to Heaven, Not Dark Yet,
Well,
Cold Iron's Bound, these are the ones that excited you.
And immediately, you know, I am a musician and I was a musician then, and certainly my immediate need to get into exactly how Trying to Get to Heaven worked. And I've always been quite disappointed by those later jazz versions of Trying to Get to Heaven, because although I know it's interesting when a song is reworked to a different purpose, yet what is I was always disappointed because I like the original so much. But what is interesting about that is, what if it wasn't retrofitted, but what if that's originally what Trying to Get to Heaven sounded like, is what was in Dylan's head, which is why he then took it back to that. And perhaps if that's one of those things about which he felt that Daniel Lanois kind of got in the way and made it. Every day your memory grows dimmer. It doesn't haunt me like it did before. I've been walking through the middle of nowhere, trying to get to heaven. Made me think, oh, that would have sounded like something on Love and Theft. If the version of Together of Knocking on Trying to Get to Heaven Before They Close the Door that you hear live, the jazzy version, that's a bit more like, you know, a Love and Theft song. So that was kind of interesting to me too.
The Jack Frost version.
Yes. But of course, yes, quite. But of course, that's what I like. But suddenly, as I said before, we have words, lots of words. I mean, not like three verses and the third one repeats and all the lines are very short and they seem to be doggerel, but, you know, and not like we live in a political world, you know, and everything's broken, this is broken, that's broken. I mean, it's all great in the series of dreams. I mean, it's like, it's all great, but what I want is words, not lists, you know? And I really, you know, you're getting into this album and you cannot avoid the totality, the theme and the conceptual. That's what I'm talking about, it less being about the individual songs. And I think this is the beginning of it being less about the individual songs and more about the totality of what the album is communicating. And this album is so consistent in its miserable, parodically, comically miserable peace of mind. And of course, as we all know, Dylan then had a near-death experience with that horrible thing, and that coloured everybody's reaction to it. But of course, as we all know, the album was written beforehand, and it is amazing. All songwriters know that you will be, things people know about you or the world will adhere to songs that can't possibly be about that thing because they were written beforehand, you know. And so this album suddenly became to people in hindsight all about death. And it is a death and sickness obsessed album with very, very few. There are some jokes on it. And that is, of course, another thing that begins here is the silly jokes, like the jokes he was telling on stage about, you know, I had a girlfriend who was a tennis player, love meant nothing to her. And he used to say these things on stage. People are like, oh, Dylan's telling jokes, hilarious. Well, those jokes suddenly started to appear in the songs. You know, the janitor who's going to sweep you off your feet. That joke then becomes a very central theme in the minstrelsy world of Love and Theft. Those silly vaudeville jokes come really front and center, you know, running for office. I mean, you get a lot of that, and that's kind of stayed there. That's still going on Rough and Rowdy Ways. So that is why Time Out of Mind, we can get back to any conversation about late style, but the later style definitely begins with Time Out of Mind. Funny thing is, what I didn't realize until I just looked up a bit of stuff about the album on Wikipedia was what I read, and Dylan was 56 and I'm 56 now. I mean, it's like, to us, Dylan felt ancient when he made this album, but you know, he's 80 at whatever, and he's just made Rough and Rowdy Ways, another fantastic and very fulfilling record. So, you know, the man is still at the top of his game when 56 seemed like ancient to be making rock and roll at the time.
Well, yeah, and that's an interesting point of this, right? There hadn't been a lot of 56-year-old rockers doing new, compelling, right, forward-thinking work. So he was kind of inventing how to do that. And the other one that is, he embraced it. He wasn't, you know, dolling up and trying to be 30.
It was never likely he would have done that, I think. I mean, he stopped doing that on Empire Burlesque because I think that cover is an embarrassment. And, you know, I think anybody, even perhaps the author, I don't mean to be rude about it, I'm just saying that even the author of that record might look at that cover and think, I don't look comfortable in that suit that I'm wearing here. And it's not really, you know, it's not really communicating anything about me at my age or the music. And that was kind of the last time he bothered to try something like that, to kind of dress up in that way. And although he always dresses natty and has always been a great dresser, particularly live on stage. But what I was going to say was, the thing that hits you immediately was the feeling of sickness on the album. It's all about, you know, I wrote some down the other day, sick in the head, love sick, numb, pain. These are all quotes, you know, scars, dead streets, flesh falling off my face, eyes falling off my face in a different song, nerves exploding, tension, nothing can heal me now, house on fire. You know, those are just random quotes I pulled while listening to it in the car. And then all that's, of course, happening in a world that is apocalyptic, where the storms are coming up, you know, typical apocalyptic stuff, the everything's exploding and everything's...
There's endless weather. Weather.
You know, it's the pathetic fallacy writ large, because Dylan's sick, the woman's left him, the weather's very bad, and there's very little that is hope of redemption. Unlike, you know, Every Grain of Sand and The Summertime and the religious albums, there's very little. You get a lot of, he's hanging on to a shadow. I'm looking at my shadow. Don't even hear a murmur of a prayer. He can barely muster, the mercy of God must be near. And when he says it, it doesn't sound awfully persuasive. So there's no doubt that out of no songs, all those years, if you'll accept my interpretation of that, comes a very brutal appraisal of where he's at and where the world is at. And the only moments of redemption are, you know, a ballad that I really think is lame, Make You Feel My Love. You know, my friend thinks it's the greatest song in the world and hopes Dylan sings it every show we go to. I don't think much of it at all. I think it's a, you know, doggerel and full of cliches. And why not Emotionally Yours? Why that and not Emotionally Yours? Then neither one is better than the other. And the fact that Garth Brooks took it to number one does not recommend it any further to me, or that Billy Joel wanted to record it, you know. But it does at least offer a moment of respite in the album. And for that, I think in the totality that I keep going back to, I think that it, even though I don't like it, I think it has a valuable place. And then you get Highlands, where there is actually some kind of ecstatic vision, you know, which is that you know, the Highlands and the Aberdeen waters and the Black Swan. And it's all beautiful. Like this is, and then the, you know, the tawdry reality, or but the charming reality of Dylan actually having communication with another human being at length, making that song. I was imagining in the car, it's like Brownsville Girl or, well, I'll come back to this, but Brownsville Girl with Clothesline Saga in the middle of it. It's like suddenly in the middle of this big epic, you've got this little close focus scene where every line is delineated, some of them apparently not worth delineating, like Clothesline Saga. But it also, of course, reminds me of the restaurant interaction in 115th Dream, which is the other place I can think of, you know, when, it, you know. And so Highland, and then I thought, what is interesting about those very long Dylan songs is they can never keep focus. Like Sad Eyed Lady of the Lowland is long, but it keeps its focus. Brownsville Girl is a very, very difficult song to follow, as we know, on every level. And I don't know whether Sam Shepard wrote all of it or Bob Dylan wrote some of it or all of it, or, you know, it's unknowable. But Murder Most Foul is a very, very long song that starts as one thing and turns into another thing altogether. And Highlands does exactly the same thing, except the other thing it turns into is right in the middle of the song, like a very long beast, like a very long bridge. And I just thought that was fascinating, that if you think of, or Lily Rosemary of the Jack of Hearts, it keeps focus, but it's incomprehensible in a way. You can't quite follow what's happening in it. It's too much. It's in his head, right? It's like when Dylan tries to explain his guitar playing style in Chronicles. It makes sense to him. Nobody else knows what the fuck he's talking about, but that's what happens when you get autodidacts talking about things that they've persuaded themselves they know how to do, and but it's very hard to explain to other people. But anyway, I'm talking about Highlands because what it does offer is a little redemptive bit in the album.
Well, you'll be interested to know that Scott Wormuth has found the language that Dylan uses to describe that guitar thing, you know, the math and the whatever, in a book, kind of a self-help book about power. So he may just be fucking with us again. And
that is not an impossible thought. I myself bought a copy of the Book of Men's Meditations that Dylan has pilfered slightly from, and I can't remember where or what, but I was reading the meditations daily for a few days, and I commend him for having read any of it at all, let alone taken anything from it. It's nice to know that this very, very minor book has found its way into some great art, you know. But anyway, so the moments of redemption, really, apart from the jokes, are really only to be found in Make You Feel My Love and in the human interaction that inserts itself into the ecstatic vision of Highlands, where he's just in his head and it could be beautiful. And then you can't quite work out, well, it doesn't matter, you don't need to work out, but, you know, there he is communicating with somebody, and she's clearly not the woman who's left him, and he doesn't know, he's sick of it, and he's following her around the world, and he'll never stop, and, you know. And then the good thing about the totality of the songs is after Lovesick, which is this rather musically, oh yeah, that was another thing that really interested me on first listen. We'd never really heard Dylan do a song structure that ended in one of those little coda bits. He's done it a few times since, but, you know, the song doesn't fade out. It ends, and it ends on a half verse, I think. It ends, you know, it doesn't end where it might normally end if you'd written verse, chorus, verse, chorus, verse, chorus. And that's much more like those old songs where it's like, you know, when you hear the beginning of some classic song, like As Time Goes By, you don't recognize it because so many of those songs have these little bits at the beginning which go, you know, people go by with love in their eye, but as time, you know, whatever it is. And many of those great famous songs, the little bits at the beginning have kind of disappeared off them. And Dylan started messing around with some much more interesting song structures here, like that coda at the end of Lovesick, which always makes for such a spooky ending of the song live, because you remember there were times when you go and see him in the 80s and you're like, how many more times is this band going to go through this verse chorus structure before anything happens? And then right when you thought it would end, Dylan would pick up a harmonica and they'd have to wheel through it all, you know, the whole thing again, because it was never going to stop in the middle. And I really like the way that Lovesick had that. It might seem a small thing, but I really like the way that Lovesick had that definite ending. Okay, think of you. And it's like, that's the end. You can't jam on after that. That's the end of the song. So that was another very appealing thing when I first heard it, the totality of meaning of the lyrics, but also the actual structure of the songs. And when Lovesick ends, you then get, what is it, Dirt Road Blues? Yeah.
Yes.
And it's exactly the same song as Lovesick. I mean, same, it's not, it's a completely different song, because it's kind of that jump blues that he's going to have one on every album, you know. But what that is, it conceptually, it's exactly the same song as Lovesick, saying the same, almost exact things, as though it could have been in Lovesick. So I immediately also dug the way that it was thematically seemed to me to be linked to each other. If you read the words of Lovesick without thinking of the tune, and then you read the words of the second song, they're almost exactly the same. There's very little difference at all, except one is a 12-bar blues structure.
How did you feel about the production? I mean, obviously it gives it that sound. You've talked about the vocal mic, which, you know, we looked at a bunch with Mark Howard. You know, some people weren't a fan of Lenoir's production. Some people think, you know, he made this album. Not that the songs weren't great, but he's the reason it's so distinctive and changed the tune for Dylan.
Well, I mean, how to say this politely? I think Lenoir was a very good producer for Bob Dylan, because he managed to make it sound. Oh, I know one thing I was thinking when I was listening to it, bits of it almost sounds like Tom Waits with the clankiness. And that is thought of as a modern thing. And Lenoir was able to give Dylan that while also allowing Dylan's voice to be right out front. So though there is quite a lot of sound on it, and it allows Dylan to be very, very in that front and center space. So I think I think both Oh Mercy and this album, and Dylan obviously agreed, otherwise he probably wouldn't have worked with him again, are very, very successful albums for Bob Dylan at those two times of his career. I also think that Lenoir's production of that Neil Young solo guitar album, Le Noise, is sensational. But as a musician, and I don't want mean this sound at all rude, I would not want Daniel Lenoir to produce one of my albums. I mean, if it meant a record company would give me, well, $20, I would. But essentially, aesthetically, it's not the kind of thing I want on my records. But that doesn't mean I don't think that it's very good for Dylan. I certainly prefer Love and Theft because I love the clarity of the sound. I don't find it's not like I'm listening so close to Time Out of Mind, but you can't really tell what's going on. You can hear Augie Myers's keyboard and you can hear the big bass. And you can hear the guitars kind of away, and you can hear that there are riffs there, but some of the things happening in the background are quite mysterious, aren't they? Probably because they are loops kind of disguised with another drum and what I did like about the album when I first heard it, and I remember this very clearly, was like some of the production decisions, like on Trying to Get to Heaven Before They Close the Door, the delay on the guitar, chink, chink, that was a bold production decision, but it really sounded great and became kind of the hook of the song. And so I liked the production, though I do not claim to be a big fan of Daniel Lenoir, to be honest. But I really liked it, and I liked it at the time.
Yeah, well, you can't look at Dylan's career and look at those two albums as not being pivotal. And
precisely, who would argue against it? Although you must, you know, some people like a, you know, some people just like a cleaner sound. And I must say, the way Love and Theft gets away with being so clean sounding because it's so beautifully arranged. I mean, we hadn't heard music as simply beautiful as the guitar introduction and twiddles on. I keep on saying Floater and Poor Boy, but they're so amazing. We hadn't heard playing that intricate for ages from Dylan, and it's such a beautifully arranged album. This album, I think, is more, I could be completely wrong, but to me, this album feels more like a studio concoction than I'm sure players obviously were playing live on it, because there's plenty of little bits you might indeed edit out if you wanted an album to be perfect without any mistakes, which has never been Dylan's goal, has always been obviously vibe and you know, that kind of thing. But it feels more like a studio concoction to me. And I don't say confection, I just mean it feels put together like a lot of it could have happened, you know, when Dylan wasn't there, once these lyrics were down. But of course, what it did in leaving the voice so out front, which was a brilliant move, and what any Dylan comeback requires, what it did was it put so heavily the focus on the words, which for the first time were, it seemed to me as the listener, almost entirely eschewing any metaphor, lots of similes kind of, but like they are, the rhymes drop like a clangor. They're very simple lyrics, very straightforward. And he said this in interviews at the time, that he wanted, you know, it was an unadorned truth. I think he said a good thing I read in the terrific David Gates Newsweek interview, which was the interview I read to kind of prepare for this. But I might have even written it down. He says something wonderful about not a single line is wasted, because nothing is there to set up something else. And in other words, there's no, you know, meaningless kind of bridging passages because he's got to get somewhere else. And that's because the late style kind of begins here, and there's much more of this interchangeable lyrics, you know, the weather's doing this, I'm feeling that. And some of the rhymes, even Dylan can't really persuade himself. The one about, you know, he's going to take to the road and plunder after thunder. It's like it just he can't quite deliver it right, because it's so kind of clunky. But so many of the words are so, the clunkiness, the brutality of the way the rhymes land, and the simplicity of the words, as though all those psychedelic, as though he's really distancing himself from the psychedelicism of the the 60s, and then the more, you know, some of the fruitier, more literary language of the 70s. You know, Street Legal is an amazing album of lyrics that are really quite overwritten in a fascinating way. But, you know, you always get your new pony second, and here we get that Dirt Road Blues. You often get that. And I think, but, you know, the way the lyrics hit, the straightforwardness of them. And I do know that one thing that's happened with Dylan, and I know this because of that wonderful Mondo Scripto project, is that he's going back and rewriting certain lyrics that maybe he doesn't like them anymore. I don't know why he's doing it. I have no idea. I wouldn't even want to speculate. But what he's doing is he's making them simpler. He's making them more straightforward. In fact, he's making them more mundane. None of those lyrics are being corrected to anything arcane or literary. They're being corrected. They're being amended to very straightforward things. My hands are full of grease. He doesn't want, I think he removes some of the fruitier things and replaces them with more basic things. And if you look through at these lyric changes, and that is a great essay for somebody to write sometime, which I would actually, that's something I would actually think about doing, because to me that is really interesting, because you could actually, not the ones he's been doing in lyrics, but the ones he's actually officially committing to paper and then singing live.
I don't know how closely you followed this, but it's interesting that in the Mondo Scripto series, he sometimes does the same song again, and it keeps changing. There's not one Mondo Scripto version. So there really is a lot there to look at.
And the reason, you know, he's been singing Tangled Up in Blue many different ways for many different years. And clearly that must mean that on some level, the version that landed on the vinyl, the one we treat as the text, I mean, I'm not saying anything, people have known this about Dylan for years, but the text is the one on Blood on the Tracks. But that's just not the text to Dylan. It's the thing that he had in his head that was the first version he recorded of. And he's been trying to change it and presumably improve it or just be happy with it or whatever. I mean, why do people change anything? I tend to leave my lyrics the same because they say what I'm meant to say. And so I kind of stick with them. But, you know, Dylan, obviously, his record-making process is much, I think, more haphazard than mine. I go in with a group of songs. They're the way I want them to go. I kind of know what I want the band to play. I don't pick people who are unprepared. I pick people who rehearse with me for some time. I do, you know what I mean? But Dylan just doesn't do it that way. So things can hit vinyl in a slightly funny way. And we think of them as so definitive, but he thinks of them more as works in progress. As we all know, that's why it was great going to see him in, you know, all these years when the songs are changing and he does a different version. I must admit, the only bit of Dylan's career I've never really engaged with is the Great American Songbook records. I haven't really listened to any of them. The only things I've heard of those are when he does them, when he's done them live. And I thoroughly enjoyed them when he did them live, except I'd rather he was singing his own songs, except perhaps it'll make him happier to sing those songs and then he'll sing his own songs better. But I just don't ever fancy putting those records on. I've never heard them. And it's just because the whole thing doesn't appeal to me, even though I heard that first album, whatever it was, with the Autumn Leaves or whatever, the very first one. And of course I heard it and I went, oh my God, he's singing so beautifully. He loves these songs. And then he did that interview with the AARP magazine, which was so genius. And it all fits together and I totally admire it. I just don't like it. I just don't want to hear it really. But perhaps it was as important as the folk songs were, or perhaps it was, you know, whatever it was.
It clearly seems to be a precursor or a thing underlying where we wound up with Rough and Rowdy Ways.
Absolutely it is. And of course, everything that's part of that process is fascinating, you know, but it's just not a period I particularly warm to. And when you think it lasted about three records longer than two and a half records longer than his entire religious period, it was quite a commitment, wasn't it? Five whole sides of LP of those.
You know, like everything else in Dylan's world, it will get a re-examination. I mean, it's as big a shift as the religious stuff in its own way, right? You got to get your head there, as you're saying, you got to want to go there for a while, and then you can start doing the layers. And what's fascinating is he can do it.
Yeah, and what's really interesting is that he was able to have that as part of his live set and then for it to disappear, but the remains of it to still be, you know, the feeling of it to still be there, the stage set, the feeling of him doing those beautiful songs was still there in his singing of the new ones, you know. So two other things before I forget. One is in Caribbean Wind, Bob Dylan sings, "It certainly was possible as the gay night wore on." That is a very old-fashioned usage of gay, and it is in fact it's an on-purposely old-fashioned usage. Gay only means one thing. I remember getting this album, and it blew my mind that he uses the word gay twice on the record. Twice! Both times to be the wonderful, you know, the old-timey, you know, ones. You've got the gay guitar, he's strumming a gay guitar, and there's the line about gay Paris. And both of those are not the gay meaning of gay. And that is a man who at 56 is positioning himself as of the past. The language is of the past. The language of Miss Mary Jane and the Buggy. Sure, he stole it from a folk song, that doesn't matter, but it is language of yesteryear. When he gets into the Timrod poetry, we're going to be getting more of that kind of thing. And a lot of this language is old-fashioned language, and that suits the simplicity of the way he's laying the lines down. The seeming honesty of every line. I this, I feel this, you did this, the weather did that, I'm sick, the world is sick. And of course, what you most get out of the album is that kind of incredible German Weltschmerz. Just the whole world is, the world cannot live up to what's in the singer's head. Everything wearies him. His health is sapped. The world is on fire. The women have left him. And there's much sorrow and very little redemption, very little of, you know, what you're going to get a lot more on Love and Theft, in fact, and what there was a lot more of before. It's a relentlessly depressing album, apart from, you know, as I said before, a few funny lines, jokes, and the interaction with the waitress, and he wants to go to Scotland, and, you know.
And the very ending, the sort of acceptance. So I'm already there in my mind, good enough for now.
Yeah. But in fact, for most of the album, you do not get that acceptance at all. That's why Highlands is a good ending for the album, and why it's nice to have Make You Feel My Love, because the consistency of the worldview, it's really relentless. I mean, you can only imagine Leonard Cohen. Well, no, actually, I think there are a lot of younger writers whom one could, you know, imagine this from. But for those of us, you know, who have heard Dylan coming through in that era of writers, it's pretty amazingly consistently. And yet the music isn't always.
Yeah. Well, Love and Theft is also distinct. Love and Theft, Make You Feel My Love is also distinct in a piano-based song. I mean, he's got the blues and the other things alternating. But besides the lyrics of that song, just musically, it's this pause.
Yes, that's,
you know, in the sort of seventh slot.
It should probably be a little. And what number is it on the album?
It is 9.
Yeah, it felt to me that maybe that, I mean, much as I don't even like it, it could have come a little earlier, that song, I think. You know, the one that always gets me in Make You Feel My Love is The Highway of Regret, and then, you know, I'll see you don't get wet. That's not good. But, you know, what can I say? Simple thoughts make simple, beautiful pop songs. And I'm sure that's one of Dylan's most successful songs of the last 20 years. And why not? It's a very, very simple song.
That the wet lyric is, I think, is in the lyric sheet. There's a distinction between the lyric sheet and what he sings. And I know, because Michael Gray talked to me about it, that what he sings is bad and the lyric sheet is worse.
Yeah. I remember talking to Michael Gray years ago. He said, oh my God, you know, you kind of wish he'd write more ballads, but then you hear the ballad he's written and you wish he hadn't written that. Very harsh, very harsh.
Yeah.
And one thing I was going to say is also, this is also the beginning of that thing where everything's not as good as it used to be, because at some point, you know, young men become old men and nostalgia becomes very, very attractive to them. And, you know, there's that line at the end, the sun is beginning to shine on me, but it's not like the sun that used to be. So even when the weather breaks, yeah, it's still not as good.
What I'm really interested in, and what you said before, this idea of him focusing on the totality.
Yep.
Rather than the individual bits, and this being the starting point of that, because I think there's a lot we've seen, and actually the stage shows, right, them becoming consistent, them becoming, I say them like plays now that he's doing, you know, and he wants to see, can he get the play right, because it's been architected to say this thing. And I think there's just lots of things in his work where I think you may have uncovered or pointed out. It's something that's interesting for us, those of us who look at it, to say, okay, well, because we tend to look at the details and the niggles and the, you know, this word there. But you're saying, if you step back,
yeah,
he's not doing the niggles. He's doing the bigger thing. We've always known that about him.
I don't want to put down any rules, but for me, the easiest way to understand the most enjoyable way to understand Dylan is to see him as a big picture and a long game player, and the things that appear eccentric, like, you know, turning up at the Grammys and looking not so great, you know, see a part of a larger game. And I don't mean that in any cynical way, but a larger plan. And certainly if you think of this as, it's one long song, this album. It's one long song in the kind of Neil Young sense. And I think that's the best way it's understood. And it makes each of its component parts more enjoyable. And I mean, I remember thinking this at the time, certainly nothing that I've, you know, thought since is particularly changed about it. And Love and Theft is the same, but I just find it to be, I find Love and Theft to be such a more beautiful and deeper vision and a man's experience of the world. I find it to me to be, it rings truer and it makes more sense to me. The wide world that's everywhere from, you know, suddenly remembering his mother's died and then his Civil War fantasies and the, you know, his household advice and, you know, Sugar Babe. And it's so, such a big record to me. And I just find Time Out of Mind, which I love, to be very relentlessly, thematically relentless. And
yeah.
And I think of it more as a whole thing rather than a lot of little bits.
Well, we do know effectively now that we're getting several discs full of outtakes and some more very soon. So
I won't be rushing towards that.
Okay. Well,
I mean, I'm sure there'll be a great thing that.
Did you like Telltale Signs? Was that interesting to you, or anything in there that you?
Oh, yeah. I thought Telltale Signs was fantastic. That was the Girl on the Greenbrier Shore.
Red River Shore, Girl on the Greenbrier Shore. Can't Wait. I mean, amazing,
you know,
stuff.
That's the point. That you've made the point. The point is not that the 80s were those albums that came out on Columbia then. The point, and it is not only what I was saying, that it's the live thing. The point is it's the archive stuff that comes out too, which, I mean, that Telltale Signs, the stuff on there dwarfs the records that were coming out on the time. It completely dwarfs them. It's a fantastic collection of tasty treats.
It's my favorite bootleg series by far. Yeah,
I agree with you. And I remember walking around Brooklyn with my headphones on, and that walk was extended 2.5 hours because I just couldn't get to the end of it. But no, I loved Telltale Signs, and I thought it was fantastic. I didn't like the, I was very disappointed with the country one.
You know, Telltale Signs was a lot of Time Out of Mind. And you say, it's beautiful. And 2, 3, 4, 5 more discs of it, wherever they give us.
And I'm sure
it'll be fun.
And I'm sure there'll be something, you know, some glorious thing they pull out, you know, and make a kind of video for the internet. And my mind will be blown by that thing. And I will be I will be interested to hear it. But it's the kind of thing, I don't know. I just have a funny relationship with all this stuff. I just think there's just too much of it. But
there is way too much. It's unbelievable.
The Dylan people have come up with a plan, and it is a brilliant plan. I completely applaud what they are providing to people, and the logic and archival depth and pride that's gone into it. No, you know, Dylan was very, very smart. They didn't put out the albums with extra tracks on it, and they've never done it. And that was brilliant, because I hate I don't. You don't know this about me, but my friends know full well. I can't stand it when you don't know where an album's ended and the outtakes have begun. It really gets my goat. Like when you have, like, you know, there's an album.
I totally agree with you.
It blows my mind. I'm playing something to my daughter or something, and I'm like, "What are you listening to?" She said, "I'm listening to the album." I'm like, "That's not the album. That's like a mono mix of some B-side." You know, don't. That's, you know, you just want to listen to, you know, you want to listen to Face to Face by the Kinks. You don't want to listen to all these extra yet. You know, that's for like old people who've run out of that first album. And it, to me, it dilutes everything. And Dylan was a genius, or whoever was advising him not to reissue the album. Everybody else did it. I've done it. You know, everybody does it. It's a good way to get them out there again. I'm no fool. But he didn't. And so that allowed for this much more in-depth. And after they'd done the first Biograph, which was a good idea, and then, you know, box sets, very rare back then they did the first Bootleg series, which was kind of a mishmash, and then they worked out how to do the Bootleg series. And since then, I mean, everything's been fantastic. And I loved the religious box set era with those, you know, those versions of Ain't Gonna Go to Hell for Anybody with lyrics you've never even
beautiful
heard.
The whole just thing
fantastic.
I think that's going to be close to what we get, you know, Time Out of Mind, meaning some studios, some live, some other things.
Because the thing is, there's no album that I don't love, and that, in a sense, and that isn't part of the totality of what's great about Bob Dylan. And so we could easily do this about Under the Red Sky. You know, I mean, sure, it itself isn't great, but what happened beforehand and what happened afterwards, what led to it, it's all just part of an amazing story. That, I mean, we're very...
The depth is just incredible. It just blows my mind that you can go this deep and there's something there. And now with the archives, or the Tulsa thing, they're showing, oh, you think you've gone deep. You know, yeah. Wait till you see what we've got.
Sure, it's, sure.
Oh, it's very unbelievable.
Yeah. And I mean, we're very lucky to have lived our various lives roughly in the same timeline. I mean, you know, that night I saw Bob Dylan on that Friday night, the 26th of June in 1981, I was remembering that I was in the rafters, and I mean, I just couldn't believe it. And so I'm 15, and this guy next to me offers me, in the last song, he offers me his binoculars. And so I'm looking and I can see Dylan doing Don't Think Twice. And I'm like, oh my God, I can almost see him. You know, like, it's like, there he is. And he's doing, no screens, of course, or anything like that. And then after about 2 minutes, the guy nudges me and I'm like, oh fuck, he wants his binoculars back. But this beautiful man, he just leant over and he just showed me how to focus them in case I couldn't quite get the right. So I was like, oh, thank you. Went back to watching Don't Think Twice. And you know, and that night, you know, seeing Bob Dylan that night was just immense. And the first time I ever saw him.
Wes, this was fantastic. Thank you so much.
If anybody makes it through any of this, well, I'd be very surprised, but God love you.
Thank you for your time. I appreciate you doing this.
Good.
I hope you've enjoyed the first of these Musicians on Time Out of Mind episodes. I had a fantastic time talking and listening to Wesley Stace, and I think you're going to enjoy the next couple episodes with Musicians just as much. Thanks for listening.